but he was invited to speak at a conference in Denmark, the Open Mind Conference. Isn't that right, James?
That is correct, openmindconference.com.
Yeah, and if I understand correctly, you made a presentation on echoes of World War I, China, the United States, and the next great war. How'd that go?
Well, you do understand correctly, and I think it went quite well. It came together, and I believe that I was able to convey my main thesis, so that's always to the good. As a communicator, that's what I'm aiming for, and there was some interesting and lively Q&A after the presentation proper as well, and that's also up on my YouTube channel and my homepage, so I hope people will check it out.
Why don't you give us an idea of your premise?
The long story short is that the world of the turn of the 20th century leading up to 1914 looked in certain key respects quite similar to the world of the 21st century leading up to our present day, namely the rise of a new industrial / economic / military power, which in the early 20th century context was the rising German nation, which was threatening the ruling British Empire. And in our own day and age, of course, we have the rising economic and industrial and manufacturing juggernaut of China, which to some extent or other is posing some sort of threat to the ruling American Empire. So I was looking at those various parallels, and I drew quite a number of different interesting similarities between the two periods, and asked the question, if all of that led to World War I back in 1914, are we heading towards World War III sometime in the future?
What's your conclusion?
My conclusion.
Do you really pose a question, or do you say this is going to happen?
My conclusion is that, of course, I don't know in what way this is going to turn out, but I do think that the parallels are there. And if this does turn into a World War I type situation, I would say that World War III, the only thing that I can say for certain about World War III is that it will not look anything like World War I. And in fact, may not even be military in nature. We're talking about total warfare in this age, in this day and age. So we're talking about economic warfare. We're talking about cyber warfare. We're talking about terrorist disruption operations like Operation Gladio B and things like this that are not thought of in the sense that we tend to think of a world war with troops lining up on a field and shooting machine guns at each other over no man's land. I don't think we're going to see that type of conflict, obviously, in the 21st century. So the only question is, what kind of conflict would World War III look like? And are we living through it already? I mean, there is a genuine question mark about to what extent this type of economic and cyber and other types of warfare are already being implemented, and exactly at what point is that line crossed and it really counts as warfare?
You mentioned that this is similar to the circumstances in 1914 insofar as we had Great Britain rulers, ruling country. Great Britain, primary ruling country, was threatened by the rise of Germany. And you compared it to the United States rulers today being threatened by Chinese rulers. But I'm wondering, who is the real ruler right now? How does this work with the New World Order? For example, is the U.S. really ruling in the sense that it rules for the benefit of the U.S., or is the U.S. has the U.S. been captured by the New World Order? And the New World Order appears to me to be subsidizing and encouraging the growth of China.
Well, I want to give you a cookie and a pat on the head, because of course you've pointed out an exceptionally important part of this.
What kind of cookie?
Whatever kind you like. Oatmeal?
Okay. Chocolate chip.
Oh, there you go. All right. Well, I think it is an exceptionally important part of both the World War I story and the World War III story that we understand that these wars, to whatever extent they do or do not occur, are engineered quite carefully. And World War I was an engineered event. Of course, the story that we're told when we're school children is there was an assassination in Sarajevo, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, 28th of June, 1914, and then all these entangling alliances, and then everyone was at war. And that is basically the way that the story is told. But the Versailles Treaty that concluded the war, or really just began the prolongation of the the truce, but until World War II broke out, assigned war guilt solely on Germany. Germany was responsible for World War I officially as a result of the Versailles Treaty and what was concluded there. That clearly is not the case. When you actually look at the diplomatic history, for example, of how the so-called Triple Entente between Britain and France and Russia came about in 1904 to 1907 in that period, and the diplomatic maneuverings of King Edward VII in that period to try to make that happen, that's a fascinating story. And clearly there was an engineered push towards World War I. They knew that war was coming, and they were basically setting it up for that entire period. And
let me ask you a question. They knew war was coming. Was it coming because there were people in positions of power who made it happen, or is it happening for natural reasons, for lack of a better term, and nevertheless people in positions of power said a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, so let's take advantage and exploit this war that's coming anyway?
A little bit of both, because certainly there were organic reasons why there would be a power clash. In fact, it's been identified very recently. There was a book by Graham Allison, an historian, who came out with this book called Destined for War, about the Thucydides Trap. And Thucydides is the Athenian historian who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. And basically he identified this trap where you have a rising power that's confronted by a ruling power, a ruling power that's confronted by a rising power, and it almost, well, Thucydides said it inevitably leads to war. You can question the inevitability of it, but at any rate, it is something that has played out many times throughout history. So to see that Germany came together as a nation in 1871, and as a result, it kind of kickstarted its industrialization, its economic productivity. Of course, it wanted more access to the seas for growing export markets and what have you. It wanted to flex its naval might, so it was starting to arm in that sense. And so it was presenting a threat to the British Empire's ruling hierarchy, or at least the control of the seas. And that, to a certain extent, that is organic. That is just part of the relations of what was happening in the continent at that time. But, of course, seeing that and recognizing where that was heading decades before it actually headed there, people in the establishment could then steer the conflict towards war, and war that would be favorable to them in their interests. And, of course, the bankers, always happy to fund both sides of every conflict and fund the one that they want to win just a little bit more than the other one, so that everyone owes them, but you know, the people who end up on top of that pile owe them a little bit more. And that's generally how these wars work. And I think to some extent we can certainly see those types of things playing out in the potential World War III scenario, where obviously there is, at any rate, there's a growing sentiment that there is going to be some sort of conflict with China, and we see that reflected in a lot of the hysteria that we see in the news coverage over China's growing military might. In fact, just this week, they did their first live fire ammunition exercises at their new naval base in Djibouti. So China is now starting to flex its military muscle internationally, even on the African continent. And this, obviously, we can extend this out and see that there is some degree of military conflict that that we're trending towards. So, as you say, well, who is really controlling this? What is this really about? Is it really about the United States of America versus China as these nation states? Or is this about a new world order? And obviously, I think it's about a bigger new world order idea. And I think that the powers that shouldn't be, the Kissingers and what have you, who are really steering this towards either towards conflict or towards some sort of resolution anyway that's more about globalism, they don't have allegiance to the United States of America the way the average American does. They have allegiance to a system that is going to ultimately lead to them as rulers of the world, and that doesn't have anything to do with the United States of America per se. So I think at the bigger macro level, this is about an engineered conflict that has been constructed for a very long time. China didn't just magically become this economic industrial juggernaut.
I agree with that.
There was a long period of setting up financial ties and banking ties and business ties and preparing the groundwork for this emergence of China. And Kissinger and people like that have been absolutely fundamental in making that happen.
Do you think, well, what is the purpose of this engineered event? What are they trying to accomplish? We're going to have a war. Okay, what do we get out of this? Is it engineered as a primary step in creating the New World Order? Is this a necessary step, or is this a different purpose? A different purpose. The aristocracy that really rules this and rules the world, they're going to get a bunch of more. They'll get a bunch more money, increase their power. What is the purpose behind the engineered event?
Well, again, I don't think it's either or. I think there are people who are involved in this system, invested in it, quite literally, who do profit from it monetarily and are happy to see the warmongering going on, whether or not that results in conflict, as long as they're getting paid. There are those people within the system. I think at the very top, this is about New World Order and the creation of a global governmental system. And as a result, it certainly, I'm not saying it necessarily has to result in war, military or otherwise. In fact, it may be the creation of the war-type environment where everyone feels we're heading towards conflict that they can use to dangle in front of the public, get them afraid, and then propose the solution, which is exactly, wouldn't you believe it, what Heinz Kissinger was basically coming out with this past week, where he is now pleading with the United States and others, no, you shouldn't be trying to resist this One Belt, One Road initiative that China's going through right now, this $1 trillion of investments throughout the Eurasian region that they're making to infrastructure and other things to create this vast trading empire. He's saying, no. If you try to confront them on this, it's going to lead to some sort of conflict. And he actually specifically invoked World War II destroying Europe, and he said, well, World War III will destroy the whole globe. We don't want that. So we have to get on board. Everybody should be part of this new Chinese-style globalization. So I think maybe they just hold out the boogeyman of war in order to scare the public into going along with the globalization that they've been lusting after the whole time anyway. As long as they achieve that end, I think that's what the top planners actually care about.
It sounds like the people in positions of power are trying to foment some sort of a conflict between the United States and China. There's something to be gained in that fundamental conflict. It'll perhaps serve the best interests of the New World Order. But which side, if this conflict, if this is like a fight that's been fixed, we're not just going to have a fight and see who can win. We're going to have a fight in theory where the winner's already been selected. Who's been chosen to be sacrificed? Somebody's coming in, going to get the poo beat out of them. Is that China, or is it the United States, or could it be both fighters?
It could be both. That's actually an interesting suggestion. But at any rate, I think the long-term goal, if the long-term goal is the creation of a new world order, a global system, that is not going to happen with the United States, obviously, as the world undisputed ruling superpower of all time and history. That is going to have to end if they want to bring in a new world order. So I think the United States will have to lose in some sense as a result of this. Whether that's simply lose its primary position as the undisputed unitary superpower, or perhaps lose in a more thorough sense. And that's an interesting proposition because, I mean, we know that, for example, I mean, the Rockefeller family has been heavily involved in China for a century plus at this point. We know that the Yalies have been very much invested in China and what's going on there, that Mao himself was a Yali. I mean, just crazy stuff like this. There's been a lot of connection between the upper elite and China for a very long time. And it would not surprise me in the least if in the event of some sort of conflict and America becoming destroyed, ravaged, undermined, bankrupted, whatever, I hate to use that term elite, the powers that shouldn't be simply migrate over to China or move their base of power over there. That wouldn't surprise me ultimately. At any rate, I know that the United States has to be taken down a peg in order for the New World Order to rise.
I agree with that because we are the one force that could put the New World Order to death. If push comes to shove and the American people wake up, we are big enough, we can take down the New World Order. It's kind of it's almost a fiction in a sense. It's a relative handful of a few very clever people that are putting a system together, but I don't think they've got people to fight for them. They can deceive and exploit, but I don't think they can deal with an open war, and therefore they have to get rid of the United States. Who is the New World Order? Is it Is it spawned by the United States? Is it spawned by Europe? Is it spawned by bankers? Who is the New World Order?
It is not spawned by nationalities or nation states. It is spawned of an ideology, the ideology mm-hmm. of collectivism, the ideology that we are all going to be living under this system of complete control by a very few at the very top. And as I say, there are different people of different nationalities and backgrounds who all desire that and are working towards that goal. And I don't think that it's 100% there's a, you know, a few people who control everything. I think that there are different power factions that are fighting with each other and that all believe that they will come out on top of this system, but they're all working towards the same system. So I do see it in the, say, the mafia analogy, where obviously the mafia wants to maintain its power and expand its power against the next mob that's trying to take over their territory. And they will fight, and they will backstab, and they will try to climb to the top. But they won't do anything to fundamentally spoil the game itself. They won't upset that apple cart. And I think that's what this is about. It's different power factions in different places with perhaps their own view of what that ultimate end goal looks like, but they're all striving towards it, and it's all based around the ideology of oligarchical collectivism, as George Orwell wrote about in 1984.
Well, it sounds like we have a fight between the ranchers and the cattle rustlers. Everybody agrees that the cattle are human resources, and the question is who gets to brand and keep the cattle? We want the cattle for beef. We want the cattle for milk, whatever. Can make money off the cattle. But the rustlers are fighting the ranchers, and we'll see how it works out. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'll be back with James Corbett on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hello, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here with James Corbett on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. We've been talking about James's presentation in Copenhagen in the last week or so that deals with the similarities between circumstances that led to World War One and current circumstances, and exploring the possibility of are these pointing to World War Three? Can we have a World War Three that's destined to diminish the United States of America without the cooperation and even treason of people in positions of power in the United States?
A very perceptive question, the simple answer to which is no. No, it could not happen without the collaboration of people within that system. The question, the real question, the interesting question is how many people would have to be involved in colluding to bring this about? And that's one I don't know. I don't have a definitive answer to. But I think it's probably not as many as most people would think. Certainly, I'm not suggesting that everyone at every high level of government office is actively involved in this. No, I think the vast majority of people in the various positions in the U.S. government, for example, are not just playing a role. They really do believe that they are acting in America's best interest and against this Chinese threat and all of this. But I see that as the two-dimensional chess game that is put before everyone. This is the lowest level of propaganda. It's us against them. It's this flag against that flag. And people in higher positions on the need-to-know basis have a slightly bigger view of that chess game and see the third dimension that's popping in and out. And I think that's where the real action is. The real question is, how big is that clique? And perhaps the more important question is, can that clique be ferreted out? Can it be somehow sequestered? Can it be controlled, contained, removed, excised, stopped before this is brought about? And that's really the key question for all of this from our perspective anyway.
What do you think is the biggest mistake America may be making at this point in time that'll make it most vulnerable? Is it reliance on the internet and the ability of a foreign adversary, even a domestic adversary, to hack into the internet? Is it our national debt? Does Donald Trump Hillary Clinton, I don't know, Democrats, what's the big problem, if you even agree that there's one big problem?
Well, of course, there are a number of potential vulnerabilities there in many different ways this could happen. But I think you point out one of the most important, which is the debt issue, which, of course, revolves around the entire idea of the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, which is why the U.S. has been able to print their debt money into existence with abandon for the past, well, half a century at least, and specifically, of course, ramping up in this era of the Iraq and Afghan wars, which in my presentation I make the point, those wars essentially were funded by the Chinese racking up an incredible trade surplus with the U.S., storing that in dollars and looking for a way to, well, what are they going to do with those dollars? They buy treasuries. So the Chinese government has more or less as a kind of, I mean, there's not really much choice. They had to ultimately buy the U.S. debt, which was funding the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is why I think the things that we see coming around right now with the Shanghai Energy Exchange, where oil futures contracts are going to be priced and denominated in yuan, and coupled with the Shanghai
gold.
Yes, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which you can convert yuan to gold. I think that's an exceptionally important part of the chipping away at the U.S. dollar. And I think that to me seems kind of the generational, like, big picture vulnerability that could really collapse an empire. Because it's difficult. Obviously, at this point, no one poses a genuine military threat to the United States. But I think financially, I think it's very vulnerable.
I agree with that. I talked about this new creation coming out of China, where they are tying gold to crude oil to the Chinese yuan currency. And the result is, I'm amazed. I heard about it for the first time maybe 10 days ago. I don't claim to understand it fully, but I talked about it in the first segment of the program before you came on. And I see this as maybe the most revolutionary financial instrument maybe we've seen in our lifetime. Someone is combining gold. It used to be gold and paper dollars. Gold backed the paper dollars. And then it went from the paper dollars being backed by crude oil. Right? Two separate phenomena. But now the Chinese are coming back and they're creating a financial instrument where the Chinese yuan is associated with both oil imported into China and gold. And according to Hugo Salinas Price, he said that the gold, if you don't want the yuan, that's fine. China will get you gold on the open market. It will be outsourced from outside of China. China's not going to redeem its yuan with its own gold. If you accept 100,000 yuan in payment for the oil you've sent, but you don't really want the yuan, China will spend the 100,000 yuan buying gold on COMEX and or the London Bullion Market Association markets. They will pull the gold from other sources outside of China to give you the gold you want. That strikes me as just extraordinary, revolutionary, brilliant, shocking. And it's supposed to be implemented, at least initiated, before the end of this year. Do you have any further comments on that?
No, I think you paint the picture. I picture it with, for example, the Russian-Chinese relationship.
Yeah,
obviously,
yeah.
They signed the big gas deal recently. And there is now truly the possibility to go completely and utterly around the U.S. dollar, not even seeing a dollar change hands, completely denominated in, they could do the contract in yuan so that Russia gets paid in yuan for its oil, and then Russia can go around and change that to gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. And
there you go.
Russia's getting gold for oil without a dollar trading hands.
This suggests that perhaps the biggest event that's happened in our lifetimes up until now may have been the establishment of a debt-based fiat currency for the U.S. dollar. We got rid of an asset-based currency backed by the asset gold and gone to a debt-based currency. And maybe are we looking at evidence that that debt-based currency may be on the verge of collapse? Is it going to last another 5 years, 10 years, or is it going to last another 6 months, 18 months?
Well, I mean, look at it this way. We, with our perspective today, can look back at 1971 and look at the speech where Nixon announces that the end of the gold standard as we've known it, the delinking of the dollar from gold, and we can look that back at that and say, well, that was a definitive moment. And obviously, in 1971, you didn't necessarily feel that when you went to the store. You know, it wasn't immediately apparent, but you could tell. I mean, if you were paying attention, you could tell that was a momentous thing. And I imagine that historians of the future will look back at 2017 and look at these things that we're seeing happening right now and go, that was the breaking point. And whether that means we're going to feel that this year or 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 50 years from now, at any rate, this is a true inflection point in history.
When we talk about a definitive moment in economics, when we speak of a definitive moment, we're inclined to think of something snapped at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday, right? Definitive moment. Do you think that when we talk about economics, definitive moments are measured in terms of perhaps a couple of generations? Can a definitive moment in economics actually be 40, 50 years? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I understand exactly what you're saying. So to speak in philosophical jargon, it's the immediate cause versus the proximate cause. So, at any rate, yeah, I see what
it's
you're saying.
It's like pulling the trigger on a gun. You
exactly,
can point the gun at your head, pull the trigger, and you can blow your brains out, and that's a definitive moment. But in economics, you can pull the trigger, and the bullet doesn't come out of the barrel for another couple of generations.
Well, and so the way to look at that analogy, then, is to say, well, this is the loading of the chamber. The actual trigger moment will be a different moment at some point. But the preparation for that moment of the pulling of the trigger was loading the gun itself. And the gun was loaded at this time. So it's, I mean, yes, the spectacular fireworks moments that everyone understands and sees and knows is the pulling of the trigger, whether that's a 1929 stock market crash or what have you. But we have to, but the real job for historians and people who really want to understand how the world works is not that particular moment of the trigger pull. It's, well, what set that up? Who loaded the chamber and when and how, and why did no one stop it? Why did no one even understand that that gun was loaded? That's really the task for, I think, people who are serious about trying to understand the way the world works, rather than just focusing on the fireworks moments themselves. In the same way people get lost in the pyrotechnics, literally, of 9/11, without understanding that it's just one day in a very, very, very much larger picture that has to be understood more in its totality to really understand what was happening on that day.
When we talk about the New World Order, we're not talking about a bunch of guys who got together after a football game, had a few beers, and said, why don't we take over the world? We're talking about something that's been going on for generations, although behind the scenes. Now, when I see something like that, it makes me believe we're not just talking about people who are involved in a project. We're going to reap the results 100 years from now, 50 years from now. It doesn't mean you can't be doing this so you can lay hands on a couple more good-looking women or buy yourself a newer car or a new mansion. That's immediate gratification for whatever it is you're trying to do. When you're working to implement a new world order over a period of decades, what motivates people to continue being faithful to that cause? Is it spiritual or can it be monetary, tangible, secular? Does it have to be spiritual? And if so, what's the spirituality behind the people in the new world order?
Yes. Well, you did use the word faithful there as well. So I think that does invoke the idea of the spiritual side of this, or the religious side or the mystical side, the sense that there's something bigger and deeper at work here, the great work, as it were.
Yeah, they're working for something that goes beyond just putting more money in the bank.
No, I agree completely, because at the most basic level of analysis, of course, the bankers who create the money out of nothing, out of debt, don't care about the money per se, right? It cannot be about that. And it's not even just about the power for themselves in that moment, because obviously, again, that's fleeting. You know, you can imagine some people being motivated by that, but really, I mean, people who will intergenerationally devote themselves, their entire family clan, to this, like the Rockefellers and others, and the Rothschilds. No, there is something deeper at work. And I guess it just depends how you define religious and spiritualism and what have you. And I think probably different people within this system have their own conceptions of what that is. But I think an important piece of the puzzle is that, as I explore in a very interesting piece that I'm going to be releasing very soon, and I will only tease it at that, one of the fundamental layers of this is a religious quote-unquote belief. I don't know if you want to phrase it that way, but a religious belief in the inherent superiority of the ruling class, the genetic superiority of the ruling class. Yep. And this goes back to eugenics, which people think of as, well, some people might think of as scientific or pseudoscientific, but in a sense is a religious belief or an extension of the old religious belief that, you know, thousands of years ago, the emperor literally was God.
Favored tribes, favored races.
Right,
favored,
and then, you have the family. Oh, this special family was chosen by God to rule over the people. And at this point, it's, oh, well, it's in the genes. They're just genetically superior. And I think it's difficult for you and I to comprehend that mentality. But people who have grown up in these families that do control the world to a large extent have such a fundamentally different mindset and truly believe themselves to be the stewards of the world, probably not in a kind sense, but at any rate, believe themselves to be superior to all of these sheeple, the cattle out there to be used and plundered. And that is the guiding idea that can unite generations of entire family lines. We are superior. We deserve to rule. And again, that's not a mentality that you and I can really access except through our imagination.
When we talk about we deserve to rule, do we also deserve, speaking as if I were part of the aristocracy, do I also deserve to survive? Could it be that what holds them together, as they said, look what's happening to population, look how populous the world is becoming, there has to be a catastrophe. All right? We can see it coming. We know it's going to happen. I want to protect myself. I want to protect my kids from all the idiots that are out there that are going to, one way or another, whether they want to or not, they're going to contribute to a catastrophe. And therefore, we need to set things up where you and I, as members of the aristocracy, will survive. Our kids will survive. We'll go on. The rest of the idiots will kill themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could it be that simple?
Well, it certainly is about control. And it is about the idea that the world is unordered. We have to bring order to this chaos. It's the squaring of the circle. It's all these things that are encoded in various religious and spiritual things and Freemasonry and all of this. It's the idea that you have to perfect what was left unperfected. And part of that is to kind of trim the rough edges of humanity. And that means we will order it. We will put it into the way that we think it will function. And obviously that's for our benefit because we deserve it. And that's the,
we're going to have to let it go at that, James. We'll worry about who's going to get the benefit of this, I suppose, in another time, but thanks very much for being on the program. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you folks for listening. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody. In the meantime, with the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd, the producer, and James Corbin. Good night.